Good evening. Let's try and start this time. Those of you who are not yet seated, it would be good if you could sit down. We still have one or two spare seats. If anyone is standing up, would like to sit down. Well, welcome this evening to the second lecture in Zygmunt Bauman's LSC trilogy. Last week's was, to recall, was The Demons of an Open Society, and it was extraordinarily warmly welcomed and greatly appreciated. I don't think I've ever been part of a lecture series where I have received so much positive feedback as a result of that lecture. All week I have been receiving emails and bumping into people saying it wasn't just a good lecture, but it was a concert, it was a performance, it was an event. So it was much appreciated. This evening's lecture, entitled Living in Utopia, is eagerly anticipated as well. Since this is Zygmunt Bauman's second lecture, I will respect his wish that I keep my introductory remarks short. As I said last time, he said to me in an email, I am not the topic of the lectures I give. And this time I will respect that, since last time I didn't. But I want to just offer a brief reminder, not of his CV, nor of his extraordinary productivity over the last 20 years, where he has literally published book after book, nor of the extraordinary acclaim these books have received in languages across the world. I almost got that in, but it's not what I'm about to say. I want to just briefly remind you of the key points of last week's lecture, because some of you may not have been at last week's lecture, so I will do something rather rude. I will try and summarize it in just six brief points, just to create a context for this lecture. As I understood it, at least, anyone talking, please? Mobiles off and people off. Zygmunt Bauman said he came from Leeds today, and I said, how was the journey? And for those of you with children, you'll know it's half term. And he said he and his wife chose the D carriage, which is supposed to be the quiet carriage. And he even commented, well, you could turn off the mobiles, but of course no one could turn off the children. So it was a very noisy journey. But some reason we're still getting echoes of others in this room. But let me just try and provide a context for the lecture by a brief reminder of what he said last week. He argued that globalization has created a negative unity of humankind. That is to say, protective barriers have been steadily eroded by global economic processes. Second, we live with a new era of global challenges, from gross global inequalities to global warming and growing political violence. Third, a crisis of political instruments or tools hinders our capacity to cope with these challenges, as power, particularly economic power, is depoliticized through global markets and politics essentially drained away of power. Fourth, in vivid terms, he said, Apocalypse Now is not just the name of a movie, but a reality in many public spaces. New Orleans and many other cities approximate this nightmare. Fifthly, today we live increasingly in a world of anxiety and fear, which replaces political engagement. Social responses become individualized, solidarity eroded. And finally, we then tend to focus on things we can influence, he said, cholesterol levels, lifestyle issues, and so on. And thus we face a very pressing question, if you're not too depressed to face it, and that is, how can we bring politics and power back to some kind of unity again? How can we shift a very negative conception and form of globalization to something more positive? Now, I brazenly attempted to summarize what he said, and no doubt he'll immediately tell you I got it wrong. But join again with me in a very warm welcome.
Dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Held summarized better than I could do it, the content of last lecture. I can summarize the summary and reminding you that the first lecture was about the world, the kind of the world in which we live. And I promised you also last week to speak today about the sort of life which we are living in this kind of the world. And I would like to start from stating the obvious, banal, trivial, observation that human life is full of surprises. Radek knew about it. Surprise was always the one of the most faithful companions of humanity since humanity appeared on the earth. In our time, surprise doesn't sound so threatening, that dangerous, because our commercial markets, consumer markets, manage to sell even nightmares as entertainment, and they did the same with surprises. Surprises in sanitized form, surprises which do not frighten, which are actually expected with some sort of a pleasurable anticipation, providing that they are indeed sanitized. So there is a guarantee, money-back guarantee that it is not really for real, that there is always someone watching and someone in control, nothing disastrous happen. We know such sort of surprises which we call pleasurable. Well, obviously Christmas tree and gifts under it, and fun fairs we have ghost trains, we have roller coasters, we have also pre-booked adventure cruises around the world in which plenty of adventure but nothing, no one threatening. Finally, we have internet dating, of which one of the frequent user of it said that he likes it more than singles bars, for example. Why? Because he can always press delete. So surprise doesn't sound that sinister as it used to, but it stands really for things unpredictable, things which, as the idiom has it, are like bolts out of the blue, unexpected and unexpectable, can't be actually predicted. They may appear from anywhere at any moment, and bringing to mind, reminding humans of their essential defenseless against what we call fate. Well, no wonder that time and again we tend to dream about the world without surprises, world with no accidents, a regular world, a predictable world, not a poker-faced world, reliable, trusty world, in other words, secure world. And Utopia is the name which, courtesy of Sir Thomas More, we commonly give to that kind of dream since the 16th century. Since the time when the old and apparently timeless routines began to fall apart, old habits and conventions started to show their age, rituals started to show their seediness, violence became rife, heretofore apparently omnipotent powers found the emerging realities too unruly and unwieldy to be held in check. This was the time of the famous masterless man, which frightened people to death because suddenly on the roads in the wilderness appeared people who didn't belong anywhere, who didn't have the master. And if you go back and study the Elizabethan legislation in Britain, you will see how much attention was paid there to this frightening phenomenon. Naturally, people reacted in traditional familiar ways. Everything was okay when everybody had a master. Now suddenly, with the first inchoate the signs of approaching modernity, people didn't know that modernity was approaching. Modernity, we called by that name only in retrospect. But the first signs were sudden production of redundant people who had no location in society, no traditional place, and therefore, by the same by the same token, they were carriers, the embodiments, incarnations of uncertainty, and symbolize the shaking ground on which people were walking. Queen Elizabeth reacted to it in a traditional way. Famous Elizabethan bill dealing with the idea, with the phenomenon of masterless men, was that they should be returned to where they came from, exactly like our own rulers now speak about immigrants, asylum seekers, and so on, who play very much the same role. They can't be accommodated in the established, in the familiar, safe, tested frames. But at that time, turbulent time, when the surprises became really disquieting, and because of their unfamiliarity, because of their novelty, because of the helplessness of the established means of action to deal, to tackle the new phenomenon, at that time, Sir Thomas produced his utopia. He knew only too well, I think, that what he written down was really a dream. Utopia is a word with double meaning, as you probably know. It could be spelled with EU at the beginning, EU-topia, or with OU-topia. In the first case, it means good society, utopia, good place. In the other rendition, it means nowhere place. So I think in Sir Thomas More, there was this mixture of melancholy and skepticism. Melancholy for a quiet world, familiar world, controllable, assimilable intellectually world, and at the same time, recognition, realization that such a world doesn't exist. Well, you can't find it. If you read the story, you know that only by some miracle you can find the way there, because otherwise it doesn't figure on any maps. He was a wise man, Sir Thomas More, and he was therefore a cautious man, dreaming about a quiet, secure society, at the same time informing his readers that such society simply cannot be found. His followers and imitators were less cautious, but much more resolute. For the next few centuries, the modern world was to be an optimistic world, a world living towards utopia. It was also to be a world believing that a society without utopia is not livable, and therefore a life without utopia is not worth living. Take Oscar Wilde, for example, what he said. A map of the world that doesn't include utopia is not worth even glancing at, for it leaves out the one country at which humanity is always landing. And when humanity lands there, it looks out and, seeing a better country, sets sail. Progress, he said, is the realization of utopias. Well, I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen, a small correction to what Oscar Wilde said here. I would say that progress is not so much realization of utopias as a chase after utopias, running away much quicker than the progress can manage to run. I think that the utopia served in modern times like the same function, which is performed by, have you been ever to dog races? There is this rabbit dummy which makes all the dogs run very, very quickly, but can never be caught. It's always faster than the most fast among the dogs. And also one could say that progress was the product not so much even of chasing after utopias as if running away from the failed utopias of yesterday, utopias which became realities and proved to be much more, much less prepossessing, much more much less attractive, much more likable than they seem to be as long as they remained dreams. Well, from across the channel came another interesting word about utopia from another wise man, Anatole France, and he pronounced an opinion which was chiming well with Oscar Wilde's idea. I quote, "Without the utopias of other times, men would still live in caves, miserable and naked." It was utopians who traced the lines of the first city. Out of generous dreams come beneficial realities. Utopia is the principle of all progress and the essay into a better future. So, by the time when Oscar Wilde and Anatole France wrote, it was already 20th century, remember, beginning of 20th century. The presence of utopia, the perennial presence of utopia, seemed to be self-evident. One couldn't imagine a longer living without utopia. That was the lasting sediment, lasting message of the modern era. Even troglodytes must have had utopias, otherwise they wouldn't stop living in caves. The first city is unimaginable unless people living somewhere in the deep forest and wilderness had an image, an utopia of a city. It seemed natural that people pursue certain pictures, certain images of a better society. Society which is worth pursuing. But I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that contrary to these beliefs, which were justified by relatively recent experience from 16th, 17th century to 20th century, contrary to these beliefs, I think that utopia is a purely modern phenomenon. Once we have the term, then we can, of course, use it to speak about Paleolithic utopias, but it wouldn't really convey the realities of that life. In order to have utopia, you need certain conditions to be met. First of all, you must believe that another universe is possible. As long as you believe in Tina, there is no alternative, you know, or if you are a follower of Theodicy, that this is the best possible world and so on, then of course there is no room for utopias. But another condition, a very important condition, a crucial one, which is very, very, very modern indeed, is that it is in the power of human beings. When they flex their muscles, when they accumulate enough knowledge and equip themselves with the appropriate technology, they can actually make the world different than it is. So confidence, self-confidence. I mentioned, I think, last week, I'm not sure, Alain Perrefitte, who wrote a wonderful study of the history of modern times, pointing out that what was the engine behind modern developments, what made modern developments thinkable, conceivable, feasible, was confidence, triple trust, in fact, trust in my own ability. If I learn the right skills, if I accumulate the right knowledge, I can do it. Trust in other people, that they are also rational beings like myself, and therefore they will probably come to the same conclusions and act and behave in appropriate way, the rational way, and so on. And trust in the institutions. We can create the forms of joint life which will promote and assure even the right kind of conduct, the right kind of behavior. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there were three I think there were two different personality types of a sort. I tried to describe them in the book on legislators and interpreters 15 years ago. One type is a gamekeeper, the other is, in my metaphorical language, gardener type. Now the gamekeeper is concerned mostly with preventing undue interference with the wisdom of creation. The primary task of a gamekeeper is to disable the snares which were set by poachers, not to influence unduly the natural, logical reproduction of game in the forest. And the essential belief, if gamekeepers were writing their declarations and their programs, they would probably write it that things are at their best when they are not tinkered with. Well, very different attitude towards the world is that of the gardener, because gardener thinks, on the other, is in exact opposition to gamekeeper, that there would be no order whatsoever in the world if not for the constant attention and effort, of course, of the gardener. And effort which would consist in encouraging the growth of the useful plants, of the beautiful plants, plants which should be there according to the design of the totality of the garden, and weeding everything which interferes with this perfect design, which should be kept out of mischief. Now, I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that first of all, these two types appear in every kind of society. There is no historical law of succession of one type after another, but I would say as well, I would suggest to you, that the typical, the average personality, so to speak, in various times, is either the personality of the gamekeeper or gardener. And the prevalence of the gardener type, of the gardener type of thinking about the world and acting about in the world, was the feature of the modern society. And I would also suggest to you that in the world populated by gardeners, utopias could be born. These two conditions, which I mentioned before, were met thanks to this sort of attitude towards the world. Today, however, one hears phrases very often like demise of utopia, or the end of utopia, or the fading of utopian imagination. I read even in The Guardian today that on this Saturday in London, someone will give a lecture which is called Loss of Utopia. Loss of Utopia. There's a common agreement that the time of utopias is over. We don't have any longer utopias. Now, the message of this paper, which I am giving to you now, today, is that, Mark Twain would probably say that the obituaries of utopia are somewhat exaggerated. It hasn't happened yet. I think we are modern people. In liquid modernity or in postmodern world, we are still modern. Modernity means that we are obsessively, compulsively modernizing. We can't actually stand people standing still. And we modernize them daily. We modernize today what we modernized yesterday, remodernize, and so on. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are in under conditions which cannot really function without utopias. So what has happened, what is wrongly, I suggest, defined as the demise of utopia, or loss of utopia, or end of utopia, or whatever, is what is happening to any other aspect of human life. Namely, what's happened is deregulation and privatization. Utopia has been privatized. First, it has been deregulated, namely, it is not any longer administered by the communal nation state or whatever institutions, but it has been subsidiarized, transferred to the realm of life politics, has been privatized. And in connection with that, I would like to add to the two types which I described in Legislators Interpreters, the third type, which is particularly visible today. And this third type, which is particularly visible today, and which is the carrier of the privatized utopia, is the type of the hunter. Hunter couldn't care less of the overall balance of things, like Gamekeeper did. And he doesn't dream of remaking the world as the gardener did. The sole task of the hunter is another kill, big enough to fill their his game bags to capacity. It may happen that if hunting is particularly successful, as one would like being a hunter it to be, then it may deplete the game which is in the forest and make life that much more difficult for the other hunters, and perhaps even the game may fall to such quantities that it won't be able any longer to replenish itself, and the woods will be lost for future huntings. But what hunters will do then? Well, he will simply move to other relatively unspoiled plots of wilderness, and he can do it as long as the planet runs out of undepleted forests. Ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that it would be exaggeration to say that we are all hunters now, in the same way as not everybody in classic modern times was a gardener, and not everybody in pre-modern times was a gamekeeper. But we are pressed to be hunters. We are sold hunting as the virtue, as the good life, as the life worth pursuing. Not only encouraged to do so, but actually threatened to do so, on the penalty of eviction from hunting, but not only eviction from hunting, on the penalty of relegation to the ranks of the game. That is, ladies and gentlemen, what is in elegant language called individualization. We certainly won't find many gamekeepers who would like to take care of the balance of creation, and the world around, it seems like that, is a world populated mostly by hunters. And in such a world populated mostly by hunters, there is no room left for utopian musings in the old sense, in the sense of imagining a social totality, a society, a community, seeking the key to human good life, to human happiness, to human decent life, a virtuous life, and so on, in the organization of our joint cohabitation of the planet. That belief that you can resolve human problems, human troubles, by coming together, joining ranks, sitting perhaps around the table, debating about the way in which this world here and now could be made slightly better. Now, that sort of thinking is not any longer very widespread. Roger Thesaurus, therefore, justly acclaimed for its faithful recording of the successive changes in verbal usages, has every right to list now the concept of the utopian in a very close proximity to words like fanciful, fantastic, fictional, chimerical, air-built, impractical, unrealistic, unreasonable, and irrational. Well, I wonder, I ask Google, my faithful helper, to find utopia on the internet. I got information in 7/10 of a second. Google prides itself for its enormous speed. In 7/10 of a second, I got 4,400,000 answers. Well, I'm not pretending to you now that I read them all. Of course, trying to do so would be to engage in the most utopian of all utopias I can think of. I didn't do that, but I think I went through a large enough sample to get the inkling how this fictional, chimerical, fantastic, allegedly irrational, and so on, is so popular. 4,400,000 websites which discuss utopia. Well, I will give you what I found. The first on the list of 4,400,000 entries, and arguably the most impressive, informs the surfers that, I quote, "Utopia is one of the largest free interactive online games in the world, with over 80,000 players." All right. And then I went on and on and on at random, but I think statistically random sample is a basis to go on to make some conclusions. And I would say that the most entries which I found, enormous majority, something like 90-95% of entries, were proving that the idea of utopia has been incorporated, appropriated, mostly by holiday, interior design, and cosmetic companies, as well as by fashion houses. All of them are offering individual services to individuals seeking individual satisfactions and individual escapes from individually suffered discomforts. That's roughly what I meant by privatization of utopia. And another impression which I got from reading the sample was the changing meaning of the word progress. Progress from a hope for a better future. In the future, all our troubles today will be mitigated or eradicated completely. It moved from this discourse of improvement to the discourse of individual survival. Look, say most of these websites, there is a progress going on. Be careful, be vigilant. Not let yourself be left behind, because if you don't try hard enough, then you will find yourself, well, using different language, not my language, but they could say that you will find yourself among the game and not among the hunters. Progress appears in this context as the need to avoid being excluded, a sort of a whip. Would whip you into unceasing movement and effort. Sometimes very strange notification come, for example, that this coming year, Brazil is the only winter sun destination this winter. Mostly to know that you must avoid being seen where people of aspirations similar to yours were bound to be seen last winter. Or you read that you must, it's all quotations, or you read that you must lose the ponchos, which were so much en vogue last year. Since the time marches on, and you are told now that when wearing a poncho, you look like a camel, as if last year you didn't. Or you learn that donning pinstripe jackets and t-shirts, so much must do in the last season, is over, simply because every nobody does it now. And so it goes. The time flows on, and the trick is to keep pace with the waves. If you don't wish to sink, keep surfing. And that means changing your wardrobe, your furnishing, your wallpaper, your look, your habit, in short, yourself, if you can manage. Well, I'm only marginally commenting on that and reminding you that there is some sort of a correlation, coordination, chiming in with this sort of reform of the idea of progress and the emphasis on the disposal of things rather than appropriation of new things, which is so closely related to the consumer-oriented economy, which will go bankrupt if people got used to durability of goods, kept, got familiar with them, liked them, and stayed with them longer than required. Increasingly, escape becomes now the name of the most popular game in town. Semantically, escape is the very opposite of utopia in this traditional sense anyway, but psychologically, I would say, it is its sole available substitute. One would say it's new rendition, refashioned to the measure of our deregulated, individualized society of consumers. Joseph Brodsky, the Russian-American philosopher-poet, vividly described the kind of life that has been set in motion by the compulsion of escape. I quote a paragraph from him. I love a lengthy one, but worth listening. First of all, he says that in general, a man, poor man, shooting heroin into his vein does so largely for the same reason you, better off person, buy a video. Accordingly, he said, you try to devise ways of escape. Apart from the self-gratifying gadgets mentioned before by him, like video or heroin, you may take up changing jobs, residence, company, country, climate. You may take up promiscuity, alcohol, travel, cooking lessons, drugs, psychoanalysis. In fact, you may lump all of it together, and for a while they may work. Until the day, of course, when you wake up in your bedroom amid a new family and a different wallpaper, in a different state, different climate, with a heap of bills from your travel agent and your shrink, yet with the same stale feeling toward the light of day pouring through your window. Andrzej Stasiuk, I recommend your attention. I hope he will be soon translated into English. Wonderful Polish young novelist. Outstanding, actually, novelist, and particularly perceptive analyst of contemporary human condition. He suggests that the possibility of becoming someone else is the present-day substitute for the now largely discarded and uncared for salvation or redemption. I quote, applying various techniques, we may change our bodies and reshape them according to different patterns. When browsing through glossy magazines, one gets the impression that they tell mostly one story about the ways in which one can remake one's personality, starting from diets, surroundings, homes, and up to rebuilding of psychical structure, often codenamed as proposition to be yourself. And another Polish novelist and short story writer, also Polish satirist, perhaps better known in this country, Sławomir Mrożek, adds to that, as if continuing Stasiuk's idea, market stall filled with the world we inhabit could be compared to a market stall filled with fancy dresses and surrounded by crowds seeking their selves. One can change dresses without end. So what a wondrous liberty the seekers enjoy. Let's go on searching for our real selves. It is smashing fun, on condition that the real self will be never found. Because if it were, the fun would end. Well, I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is roughly the utopia of the hunters' generation, and hunters' era. It remains to be seen how long it will take. The dream of making uncertainty less daunting and happiness more permanent by changing one's ego, and of changing one's ego by changing its dresses, is the utopia of hunters, the deregulated, privatized, individualized version of the old-style vision of good society, society hospitable to the humanity as of its members. Well, it's very much posthumous verification of Blaise Pascal, old prediction or observation that we prefer the hunt to the capture, he says. Prevent the hunt to the capture. The hair itself would not save us from thinking, but hunting it does so. On the contrary, suggested Blaise Pascal, and one can gather quite a lot of proofs how right he was, that we begin to actually fear catching the hair, because really the fun would end, and the escape from the world which moves forward, leaving us behind, wouldn't be implemented. So is that the end of utopia? In one respect it is, in as far as the early modern utopias envisage a point in which time will come to a stop. Indeed, they were pre-Francis Fukuyama, only they didn't say that what Francis Fukuyama describes as something which already happened, that this really did happen. No, they only dreamt of that happening at some point. End of history. End of history. Rest, time of rest. First, there is a long, long period of effort, of very hard trying, of delay of gratification and so on, all sorts of sacrifices, and later at the end there will be moment of rest, state of rest. Now, there is no such point in hunter's life. No moment where one could say that the job has been done, the case open and shut, and mission accomplished, and so could look forward to the rest and enjoyment of the booty from now to eternity. In a society of hunters, a prospect of an end to hunting is not tempting, but frightening, since it may arrive only as a personal defeat. The horns will go on announcing the start of another adventure. The greyhound's bark will go on resurrecting the sweet memory of past chases. The others around will go on hunting. there will be no end to universal excitement. It is only me who will be stood aside, excluded and no longer wanted, barred from other people's joys, just a passive spectator on the other side of fence, watching the party, but forbidden or unable to join the revelers, enjoying the sights and sounds at best from a distance or by proxy. So it's very interesting utopia, this deregulated utopia. It's a utopia of no end, possibility of going on and on endlessly, infinitely, changing your dresses, your wallpapers, your families, your climate, your surroundings, and never for a moment stopping for long enough to begin to reflect. So it is utopia all the same, as it promises the same unattainable prize all utopias brandished, namely the ultimate and radical solution to human problems, past, present, and future. But it is unorthodox, an unorthodox utopia, mainly for having moved the land of solutions and cures from the far away into, mind you, here and now. Hence the title of my paper today. I suggest that unlike our ancestors who lived towards utopia, we are living in utopia. We are living inside utopia. For the gardeners, utopia was the end of the road. But for the hunters, utopia is the road itself. Well, there are many signs, a lot at first glance related to what I'm talking about here, but I think there is very close connection. I would like to bring them into our debate, into our discussion, and ask you to think about it, what sort of connection there is. Well, I told you before that the time of utopia, of the classic utopia, of the belief that a better society could be achieved and humans are potent enough, equipped with reason to do that, to make it better. Now, at that time of utopia was saturated with trust, with confidence, confidence in human power, confidence in human collective ability and individual ability as well, if the individual is in the right type of collectivity, to do things intended. There is no such trust, so that trust, not so such confidence, widespread in our type of society. And one of the symptoms of that, which I would like to suggest to you, is our passage from the civilization, what I call civilization of saving books, to civilization of credit cards. We live on credit. No past generation, as you probably read in The Guardian, in The Independent, The Times, and virtually every other paper apart from Daily Mirror, that no other generation was so heavily in debt as the present day generation of Britons, and I think that actually it is done with enthusiastic support of our governments, because they train all of you to live on credit, spend money which you haven't earned, and in fact I think that living on credit became thereby, by introduction of student loans, I believe it became the part of the curriculum of national education. So we live on credit. The task of state budgets used to be before to balance the books. Nowadays, the budgets are expected to specify the excess of spending over income. Living on credit has its utilitarian pleasures. Why to delay the gratification? Why to wait if you can relish future bliss here and now? Admittedly, with the lack of confidence in the blind nature of progress, undirected, uncontrolled nature of progress, future seems to be beyond control. But credit card magically brings that vexingly elusive future straight into our lap. We may consume future, so to speak, on the spot, in advance, when there is still something to consume. This seems to be the latent attraction of living on credit, whose manifest benefit, if you believe the commercials, is purely utilitarian, pleasure-giving. And if the disaster strikes, and before that future has the chance to show you just how nasty the disaster might be, you can actually consume what otherwise you wouldn't be able to. Well, there's an old saying, enjoy now, pay later. The newer version, updated courtesy of credit card companies, if you remember how credit cards were introduced into popular use several years ago, the updated version is take the waiting out of wanting. Well, I suggest to you that media being messages, all media being messages, credit cards are also messages. Saving books assumed the certainty of future. An uncertain future cries for credit cards. Saving books grow out of a future one can trust, a future certain to arrive, and once having arrived, to be not dissimilar to the present. Future as we value what we value, respect the savings, and reward their holders. Saving books also grow out of hope, expectation, confidence, that thanks to that continuity between now and then, what is being done right now in the present will shape the then, tying up the future before it arrives. What we do now will make the difference, determine the shape of the future. Credit cards and the debts which credit cards make easy would frighten off the meek and disturb even the adventurous among us, if not for our suspicion of discontinuity, caginess that the future which will arrive will be different from the present which we know. So there is no knowing in what respect it will differ and how far. Would it, years from now, honor the sacrifices done presently in its name? Would it reward the efforts invested in securing its benevolence? That we don't know and can't know. And there is little point in striving to control or to bind the unknowable. Well, hence, credit cards in the pocket, and let's worry about that bridge when we come to it. Some bridges, however, are close enough to worry already now about them. They are near, so one needs to take into account that sooner than later, one will have to cross them. And hence, we have a new notion of Risikogesellschaft, notion of risk society. We have risks. We have risks, and the wisdom of life in this kind of society, liquid modern society, postmodern, late modern, however you call it, is to calculate the risk. What is hidden in this reason? However, is that by definition, therefore, risks are such dangers whose probability we can calculate. Risks are the calculable dangers. Once so defined, risks are the next best thing to, alas, unattainable certainty. Let us note, however, that calculable doesn't mean predictable. Probability, even most earnestly calculated, offers no certainty that the dangers in question will or will not be avoided in this particular case then and there. But at least the fact that we have done our computation of probabilities can give us the courage to decide whether the game is or is not worth the candles. We have done something reasonable and perhaps even helpful. Now we have reason to consider a probability of bad luck too high to justify the risky measure, or, on the contrary, too low to stop us taking our chances. More often than not, however, ladies and gentlemen, switching attention from dangers which are, unlike risks, uncalculable, to risks, switching attention from dangers to risks, proves to be, in the end, another subterfuge or an attempt to evade the problem, not a passport for safe passage. It tapers our precautionary efforts on dangers that can be anticipated and can have their probability computed, whereas the dangers, by far the most awesome and fearsome, are precisely those impossible or excruciatingly difficult to anticipate, the unpredicted and perhaps even unpredictable ones. Busy calculating the risks, we tend to sideline that worry and so manage to keep the catastrophes which we are impotent to prevent away from sapping our self-confidence. Focusing on things we can do something about, we are left with no time to occupy ourselves with reflecting on things about which we can't do, it seems, anything anyway, because we lack the means and we lack the determination to find them. This helps us to defend our sanity. This keeps nightmares and insomnia at a safe distance. But this does not necessarily make us more secure. Well, ladies and gentlemen, after this rambling presentation of the living in utopia and its consequences, I would like to conclude that unlike the utopias of yore, the hunter's utopia does not offer a meaning of life, whether genuine or fraudulent. It only helps to chase the question of life's meaning away from the mind of living. Having reshaped the course of life into an unending series of self-focused pursuits, each episode lived through as an overture to the next, it offers no occasion for reflection about the direction and the sense of its all. When or if finally such an occasion for reflection comes, at the moment of falling out or being banned from the hunting life, it is usually too late for the reflection to bear on the way life, one's own life, as much as the life of the others, is shaped, and so too late to oppose its present shape and effectively dispute its propriety. Well, I anticipate that you ask me what to do. That's the right question to ask. Securely, for the sake of my own security, I transfer this issue to the next lecture, so I won't speak about it now. So you can live in a comfortable illusion that I have an answer, which I don't. At least for the next 10 days. So the only way I can summarize what I just said would be to quote from one of my beloved writers, Italo Calvino, from whom I learned quite a lot about the nature of the world we live in, perhaps even not less, if not more, than from sociological books. So Italo Calvino put into Marco Polo lips in his invisible cities the following. The inferno of the living is not something that will be. If there is one, it is what is already here. The inferno where we live every day, that we form by being together. There are two ways to escape suffering it. Two ways. And I tend to agree with him. The first is easy for many. Accept the inferno and become such a part of it that you can no longer see it. The second is risky and demands constant vigilance and apprehension. Namely, seek and learn to recognize who and what in the midst of inferno are not inferno. Then make them endure and give them space.
Before I take questions, just three brief announcements. The third installment, what it is that Zygmunt might say when he's decided how to offer us greater guidance, is a week Tuesday in 10 days' time, again at 6:30 here in the Old Theatre. Secondly, there's a reception. No idea, but it's a week Tuesday. Anyone got the date? 8th. Thank you. It is a week Tuesday. The second announcement is that there's a reception on the fifth floor of this building in the senior common room at the end of this lecture. For that is to say, for all you gardeners and gamekeepers, no hunters with credit cards welcome, which I guess rules me out for a start. Or to put it more seriously, for all academics here this evening and for all research students, by that I mean MSc research students and PhD students. I'm sorry we have to draw a line, but otherwise the senior common room will be overcrowded. So at 8 o'clock, upstairs, fifth floor, all of you who would wish to join us, who are academics here or researchers, are welcome. And finally, questions. I will follow the format of last time. We will take, I think, smaller clusters, maybe three clusters of questions at a time. Zygmunt, as he puts it, is deaf, quote, end quote. He's hard of hearing. So your questions must be well-formulated, sharp, and short, and if you were
loud.
Here, and very, very loud, so you must speak right into the microphone, and if they're not, you'll find me brutally rewording them. So let's take three questions first. Put your hands up so we can get the mics to you. Loud.
Okay, do you think that the utopia of the hunter is characteristic of a decaying society, such as the West, and the utopia of the gardener is characteristic of a rising society, such as India or China?
Good question. You got it? I'm happy with that. Second. Yeah, well, let's carry on.
Good evening. Since you're so critical of the media, is it utopic to think that it can be an instrument of liberation rather than one of domination that economic elites use to construct our own definitions of utopia?
This is a question about the role of the media. This is a question about the role of the media. Yeah. And the question is basically, is the media always locked into a sort of dysutopian position, or can it have a more critical function? Is that reasonable? Summary? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Anyone down here? Very quiet on the ground floor. Yes, upstairs.
Hello.
a question. Would this be utopia with
hopeless.
And
hopeless?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Would this be a utopia with confidence and trust if you could rebuild local social cohesion?
Would it be utopian to try and rebuild local social cohesion? Is that a project that's an antithesis to the contemporary age you're describing? One more down here. I've got to take some questions down here. Yeah. Wait. Don't. We need a microphone.
Yeah. Surprisingly to me, the role of religion and the New Age spiritualism was not mentioned in this phase of modernity.
Role of religion, yeah. You didn't mention it.
The role of religion, the New Age spiritualism, was not mentioned at all in the entire course of this lecture in terms of the melting modernity. What role does it have in this current context and in his answers?
In short, your secular analysis excludes the role of the spiritual and the religious. And do you want to take this opportunity to rebuild it into your account?
Voila.
Should we try one more from down here? There's a sociological prediction you can make. It's very interesting, having observed this year after year in the Miliband lectures, that male speakers beget male questioners and female speakers female questioners. It's very interesting, and today we're entirely consistent with this sociological prediction. Yes, please.
I'm wondering if there's any connection between the apocalypse and the utopia. In other words, if increasingly this possibility of apocalypse gives us the idea that everything can get worse, does it create the inverse that everything can get infinitely better?
Yes. All right, Zygmunt, your floor.
Your floor? Well, I tried all my life. That's one thing I was faithful to, not to be determinist in any way. I really do believe in the human agency, that people can choose, and even if they think that they can't. I can't think really of a situation in which there is no choice. We found out in studies that even ultimately, read Primo Levi, who sees that even in under extreme conditions of a concentration camp, there is still a choice. I was not there for economic determinism. The determinists, I didn't believe that the condition of economy, means of production, and so on, determine necessarily human behavior. But I'm afraid that we are living again through a new, well, not again, we are living through a new incarnation of the old idea of determinism. We are inveterate, we humans, inveterate seekers of necessities, inevitabilities, and so on. This time it is cultural determination, that certain culture determine possibility or not possibility of this or that. The development of events, development of history, normally falsifies such predictions, as it did, for example, Max Weber's famous study of the relationship between religion and the possibility or impossibility of modern developments of capitalist relationship and so on. It transpired that that these forms of life, new forms of life, transgress the boundaries quite easily, also boundaries between civilization, cultural traditions, and so on. So I don't think that hunter culture, if you want to put it this way, is the product of the West and, gardeners are, the attitude of gardeners is related directly to China or India, to Eastern civilization. If I have to collect hunters, the emergence of the hunter, the proliferation of the hunter, I would collect it rather with the neoliberal reform in the structure of our societies in the West. After all, the idea of utopia, which was born of the gardener's attitude toward the world, was born also here in this part of the world, only under different conditions, in a different sort of a social organization. That's roughly my answer. I think that there is no one-to-one relationship. That's my deep belief, and I don't have proof to the contrary, between certain attitudes towards life problems and a certain selection of the means to deal with them, on the one hand, and a cultural tradition on the other, or the civilizational tradition on the other. The same very much applies to the problem of religion. Problem of religion as which determines or not determines the choice of life attitudes in, I don't mean on Sundays or Fridays or Saturdays, depending on the holiday in the week, in one or another religion, but in daily life, in daily life. You can look around, say, Christian countries, and you see the numerous differences between the way they live their, they organize their joint life. You could live around Islamic world, you see also all nuances, all possible nuances in the field of selection between these attitudes which I, or the personality types which I referred to. So I've tried to be cautious when I spoke today. I don't know whether I was successful in displaying this cautiousness, but I wanted to say that I even didn't I said that all three types are in fact present in every kind of society and in every historical era. Only it so happens that at certain points there is condensation of one type at the expense of others. And the point which I was trying to make particularly emphatically was that in our time and in our place here now, there is a new phenomenon of the proliferation of the hunter type at the expense of the two others. But I don't believe that there is one-to-one determination between any kind of era, however you define it, or any kind of territorially fixed tradition which predetermines such an occurrence. Cohesion, that's the very important point. Is it utopia? Well, cohesion of national society was a utopia of the Soviet modernity. That was where the, after that utopia, most efforts were chasing, efforts of reform, efforts of improvement. One can actually trace the reasoning which relates the planned reforms of early capitalist society and early modern society trace as related to the underlying vision of a kind of society which will be good, which will be good in the sense of providing decent conditions of life, and also in good in the sense of equity, of degree of justice, and providing also conditions for dignified human life. I would say that the crisis of identity, of utopia, which is so commonly believed is the case today, is related to what I was talking about a week ago, namely to the divorce between power and politics, and power escaping from the level of the nation state, so that nation state is no longer a credible address of the hopes of rebuilding society. It's not believed to be powerful enough. It's not believed to be potent enough. It's not believed to be sovereign enough on its territory to be able to do so on its own. I am inclined in part to share this view. Namely, I believe that contemporary problems, also those problems which promote, which prompt the development of the hunter attitudes, are of global origin. They are born in this global cyberspace, no man's land, which extends beyond the reach of a nation state's instruments of action. And I also believe that problems of global origin, global problems, cannot find their local solutions. So there can be no local solutions to the global problems. I believe if utopia, in the traditional sense of a good society, could be reborn, could be restored, it could only reappear in the form of a utopia of humanity, humanity as a whole. That's our utopia of our days. The dream of assuring decent life to everybody, a good life, good in the framework of the global society, which doesn't exist, which doesn't exist. So the road is very far and difficult, and it needs on the way to create the object of its dreams, namely the global society. A lot is written today about emerging civil society, global civil society. I would very much like that was true. I would very much like that was happening, because on this ground, and only on this ground, I think the utopia of a good society, namely human happiness assured by collectivity, by community, by cohesion, by living together, by respecting each other, by talking to each other, and so on, could be reborn. Apocalypse was mentioned, catastrophe, threatening was mentioned, how one can speak about utopia under these conditions. I think that the apocalypse now, a kind of night dream, which is also very widespread, and the crisis of the traditional utopia, utopia of good society, I think they are very closely connected. They are very closely connected. They derive from the same sources, as I see it. And I repeat again what I said last week, that it's my deep conviction, rightly or wrongly, that this is in turn, the sources lie in the discrepancy between the grandiosity of the challenge and the relative mediocrity of the means which we have available in order to deal with these challenges. And that's again the same problem, divorce between power and politics, power without, free from political control and direction, politics stripped of a good deal of its power, so unable to act, and under this condition you have these consequences. We speak about apocalypse because the disasters, threatening disasters, acquire more and more the character of unpredictable things, which strikes unexpectedly, which can't be predicted, and even if predicted, cannot be prevented. widespread literature, I could recommend to you, which discusses this issue. I mentioned last week Hans Jonas, one of the probably greatest ethical philosophers of 20th century, who pointed out that we have acquired now, we, the human beings, humanity as a whole, acquired tools, instruments, weapons, which are able to act on enormous distance, which you neither see nor even can envisage and imagine. An enormous distance both in space and in time. In space, because the repercussions of our actions undertaken in any place of the globe can have completely unanticipated and unexpected consequences for people living far away from us in somewhere in the nooks and crannies of planet which we would never visit, but also in time, because what we are doing now, we say the natural resources of Earth already predetermined, pre-designed conditions under which our great-grandchildren will live, great-grandchildren whom you will never meet, never see, but we already trimming the conditions under which they will have struggled with their own problems. So on the one hand, enormous potency of our action. On the other hand, says Hans Jonas, our ethical imagination, which hasn't advanced since the time of Adam and Eve. Which means that we can see only, we can have ethical imagination which is confined only within the family household or local community or one nation state, not beyond the fence. Now this discrepancy according to Hans Jonas, the primary, the ultimate source of uncertainty which haunts us. Because we don't control, not nature, it's not the question of controlling nature now. It is the question of controlling the outcomes of our own actions. They are uncontrolled. And they rebound on us as catastrophes. And quite recently, I recommend to you, I hope Polity Press will translate it into English, Jean-Pierre Dupuy published a wonderful book which is called Catastrophisme Éclairé, the Enlightened Catastrophism, which he recommends as our obliging philosophy to prevent catastrophes, because what he says is that the surest way of making catastrophe unstoppable is to believe it is impossible and incredible. Thank you.
Well, on that note, I think we should probably give Zygmunt Bauman a quieter decarriage, and it's certainly an apposite moment in which to, I think, draw everything to a close. So the third lecture is a week Tuesday. You now know the date as well. Thank you very much, Zygmunt.